So we pick up in chapter 14, and we are now in that section of the Old Testament that covers the life of Abraham. So we've looked at the creation, we looked at the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3. We looked at how sin, once it was introduced in the world, all the things that happened, and eventually the entire world was corrupted except for Noah and his family. So God saves them through water. Then we get to the Tower of Babel, and God's already made a promise. He's not going to destroy the world the way he did before, and yet here we get to the tower, and God's told the people to go be fruitful and spread out and divide over the earth, and they have this plan not to. So God divides them, and he divides them into nations, and then God decides from there that he's going to work with one man in particular, with Abraham. And so Abraham is called out of the land of Ur. And in Genesis chapter 12, he's told, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So now we begin to follow the life of Abraham instead of following the life of everybody on the planet, as we've essentially been doing previously. So now, as we've looked at him, chapter 13, he's come into the land. He's taken this 2,200-mile journey from Ur all the way to the land of Israel. He did it in essentially two sections. The first section got him to Haran, where then his father passed away. And then after that, he traveled from Haran down into the land of Israel. He's actually traveled outside of Israel at this point, gone down to Egypt, and we saw the things that happened there with him saying that Sarah was his sister. So we're quickly beginning to get a picture that Abraham is not a perfect man, and that he certainly sins and makes mistakes. But what we do see, though, is a faithful man. Which brings us to kind of the overarching idea that we want to get out of Genesis, in particular when looking at Abraham. Turn to your Bible over to the New Testament and go to the book of Galatians. If you're in the Bible Readers Group on Wednesday morning, you are going to be familiar with this because we just covered this there. But if you go to Galatians chapter 3 and... you move down to about verse 6, and that'll be where I'll start the reading. It says, even so Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of faith who are sons of Abraham. The scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, all the nations will be blessed in you. So then, those who are of faith are blessed with Abraham, the believer. Romans will go so far as to say Abraham is the father of the faithful. So as we read through Genesis, we have the scriptures which foresee where this is going. So, right, you know, as God is guiding the hands of Moses and all the other writers of the Old and the New Testament, God sees the whole story and the whole arc of it. He's including details of Abraham's life so that you and I would understand a couple of different things. One, we need to understand that Abraham is faithful, and that he is faithful and the father of all faithfulness for all nations, not just for Jews. Because when God called Abraham out of the land of Ur, was he a Jew or not a Jew? Not a Jew in any way, shape, or form. In fact, what is the sign of the covenant of being a Jew? What's the sign of the covenant God gave them? Circumcision. Has Abraham been circumcised at this point? Not even been introduced into the picture. All we know is that all the nations will be blessed through him. Now, you go back to Galatians, and later on, God will add to the promise that he initially gave Abraham in Genesis 12, where he says, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed, and he'll say, through your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And Galatians will clarify that seed. That's a singular seed, a singular descendant of Abraham, not through all of its descendants, but through one in particular, and that one in particular is Jesus. So what we're seeing here is a man of faith, and God is laying out that picture. And already, without getting very far, we've seen a couple of character traits of Abraham that are worth noting. One, he's not perfect. We've seen that clearly in that he was so afraid of the king of Egypt, of Pharaoh, that he told Sarah to be say that she was his sister, and so far that he keeps the deception going even when Pharaoh takes her into his own house. Now, so it's like one thing to say, okay, well, we're traveling through here, make sure and tell everybody you're my sister. But then, like, the guy takes her to go and be part of his harem, and he still doesn't say anything. So we're not dealing with a perfect man by any means, shape, or form. But on the other hand, when God told him to leave Ur of the Chaldees, and if you remember last week, we showed some of the archaeology from that time period. It was a very affluent, powerful, prosperous area. And we have every indication that Abraham was a part of a very prosperous, wealthy family. For him to leave that and go to a place he'd never been before is an act of great faith, especially when you consider that by the time you get to the book of Acts, Stephen mentions that the forefathers of Abraham were not all worshipers of Jehovah. What do they worship? Idols, idolatry. So Abraham, he's kind of charting and blazing a brand new trail. So then, by the time you get to chapter 14 here, he's now traveled into the land and out to Egypt, and now he's come back to the land again, and he's got Lot with him, and both of them have had such prosperity, their flocks and herds have grown to so much that he tells Lot, you choose where you want to go and I'll go the other place. And Lot chose to live in what region? Yeah, Sodom. He lives in Sodom, which was a very beautiful place at the time. Not going to stay that way. But chapter 14 picks up from there, and what we find is that there's now going to be a battle amongst the people who live in the land. Because as much as Abraham is a wealthy, powerful man, how much of the land of Canaan does he own? None of it. Zero. So he is a nomad. He is a wanderer in a strange land. He is, as Hebrews says, a sojourner. He's just traveling through. But there are other people who do have cities there. They do live there, the Canaanites. And so several of them, of the kings of that particular area, decided to make war with the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah. So why would that affect Abraham at all? Why would he care? Yeah, Lot. Exactly. Yeah, because Lot's living there. So, turns out, and this is where I skip a little bit in order to save a little bit of time. It says they go to war, and then you get down to verse 11. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. They also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. So now all of this has happened. Lot, who took the great land, right? How well has that played out for him at this point? Not worked out so great, right? Then verse 13, it says, a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now, this is the first time he's ever referred to as a Hebrew. Hebrew means he makes coffee. No. Hebrew means he's a wanderer. It's a sojourner is the idea. So it's So, and you can think about, if people asked in the land, everybody else lives in cities and whatnot, hey, what about that guy? He seems to be a pretty wealthy fellow. Who's that? Oh, that's Abraham the Wanderer. And so you can see it's essentially a nickname that he received. But then later on, you think about how that would stick and that the Jews would be known as Hebrews. So it says he came to him. And it says, when Abram, down verse 14, heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. So here, you only every once in a while get some insight into the wealth and power of Abraham. We've said it before, he's a wanderer, but he ain't poor. 318 warriors, and they're all his servants, and it gives another detail. What is it? They're all born in his house. So these aren't just people he's even acquired. This is a legacy of servants. So how powerful a man is Abraham to have his own personal born and raised militia? And so they went in pursuit as far as Dan. Here, you can look at this map here. Dan is up at the north of Israel. In fact, if you, these are terms that you'll hear throughout our studies of the Old Testament, so it might be worth taking a moment to mention this. If you want to talk about the northernmost border of Israel and the southernmost border of Israel, you'll say from Dan to Beersheba. Dan's up at the top, Beersheba's down at the bottom. So they have taken Lot and his possessions and his whole household, and so Abraham now is going to pursue him, and he pursues him all the way to Dan. So essentially, all the way to the edge of the country. And it says, he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. That's up actually further north in Syria. He brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions and also the women and the people. So Abraham goes to war. Abraham wins the war, brings all of Lot and his possessions back. And then a very interesting thing happens. It would not be interesting if you didn't have your New Testament, but since you do, it is. Verse 17, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, and now he was priest of God Most High. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, that is Abraham, gave him a tenth of all. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give the people to me and take the goods for yourself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, for fear you would say I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their share. So now we have this short little thing after the battle. Abraham goes back and he gets to Salem. And Salem sounds an awful lot like another city you're very familiar with. Jerusalem. Yeah. And this is the predecessor. Salem is Jerusalem. It's the same location. And there's a king there called Melchizedek. You've never read about him before, and you're never going to read about him again. You don't know anything beyond this event. He's king, and he's also priest of God Most High. So, several different things. Even before we go and look at the New Testament on it, we've been following Abraham and how God is working with him. Does that mean that God doesn't care about any other human being on the planet? No, right? Here's Melchizedek, priest and king to God Most High. We don't know anything about him, but here is a man who is serving and worshiping God. We don't know the rest of the story. He is not the only one that you're going to find that to be the case with. That will also be the case with Moses later on. Moses is going to have a father-in-law called Jethro who worships the God Most High. And you say, well, what about him? I don't know anything about him other than he was Moses' father-in-law. But we have these small little snippets of detail that tell us that there's a bigger world going on where God is interacting with people. And people are learning and serving him beyond what we know. But we're following Abraham for one reason. What's the whole value and purpose of following Abraham? It's the seed. That's right. It's the Christ. Because he's the one through whom all the families of the earth will be blessed through Jesus. So that's the first thing. Now, go and turn over to Hebrews with me. So, Hebrews chapter 7, in the book of Hebrews, in discussing how Jesus is not a Jewish priest. There are several different reasons you know that Jesus is not a Jewish priest. First of all, Jewish priests all come from what tribe? Levi, yeah. And Jesus is from what tribe? Pop quiz. Judah, yeah, he's from Judah. Okay, so Jesus comes from Judah. He's not from Levi, can't be a priest. And Jesus is something that a priest never is under the Jewish law. He's also king. Jesus is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and also priest to God Most High. Under the Jewish law, the kings always came from Judah, and the priests always came from Levi. You never had the same job in one person, and yet we do. So Hebrews 7, in describing how Jesus is that, goes back and talks about Melchizedek. It says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem," which is king of peace. So that is, Melchizedek means righteousness, Salem means peace. "Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. Now observe how great this man was, to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. And those indeed are the sons of Levi who received the priest's office, have commanded the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is from their brethren, although these are descended from Abraham. But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham, and bless the one who had the promises. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. And so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him." So here's the point that Hebrews makes. Jesus is king and priest, and Jews go, no, that can't be. Well, it can't be under Jewish law, but has it ever happened before where there was a king who was also a priest? Yeah, Melchizedek, it has. So you go back in your Old Testament, and Hebrews is, you notice, that word we just talked about, it's called the book of Hebrews. It's to these Jews who should know their history. He goes, don't you remember there was a king and a priest before? His name was Melchizedek. And how much did Abraham value and trust and consider Melchizedek? Well, when Abraham met Melchizedek, what did he do? What did he give him? A tenth, a tithe, right? And so his point is that Abraham looked at Melchizedek and said, this guy's serving God, this guy's right. And so Abraham, the father of all the Jews, paid that 10% to this guy who was king and priest. Now, what do you know about Melchizedek after that? Nothing. He says it's like he had no father, no mother, no genealogy. He just kind of pops up and he appears and then he disappears. You don't know anything beyond that. Now, think about Jesus. Now, I could say on one hand, who's Jesus' mother? And you would say who? Mary. But did Jesus exist before Mary? Yeah. So is it fair to say that Jesus has always been, so in one sense he has neither mother nor father? Yeah. So he is just like Melchizedek. He's a priest and a king perpetually throughout all time. And so here's this little story. Now this is not the only events that happened in Abraham's life. I'm sure there was plenty of other things that happened in Abraham's life that we never read about whatsoever. When you get to heaven, you might ask him, hey, what happened in your life that you never told us? But this is here so that you and I would be able to make this connection in the New Testament and understand that Jesus is the King of righteousness and the King of peace. And he's perpetually so. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it might also be, I think it's Zechariah 2 that talks about how the offices would be joined. Like there are multiple prophecies, and you mentioned the Psalm 110, which is, that's the one that's quoted in the chapter before, right?
It is quoted, yeah. The Lord is born and will not change his mind. You are a priest
There you go. Okay, so yeah, this is something they should have been looking forward to. So yeah, absolutely. And it's Hebrew, the Hebrew writer is essentially schooling them. He's going, you should know your history. Yeah, so especially of your most famous person, right? Because it's the history of Abraham. So yeah, you're absolutely right. This was a prophecy, messianic prophecy, that the Christ would be of the order of Melchizedek. Anybody else have any other comments or questions? Okay, so then that we go through that whole event, and like I said, if you didn't have the New Testament, we'd probably just skip right over it not even realize what a big deal it is. But here again, you see that character of Abraham that he makes a point. He says, I don't want to get rich off of the spoils of war, so you keep everything. I'll just take what the young men have eaten. And then you get to chapter 15. Now we get to chapter 15. It says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Now, one of the things that we should remember is that we are reading in a short amount of time these different things that God said to Abraham. But it's short amount of time because we're reading it at chapter markers. This is not a short amount of time for Abraham. So what we're reading quickly were years of Abraham's life. So Abraham, he's come into land, he's now lived here, he's gone through all the routine and changes of life, and God comes to him again and he says, I'm a shield to you, do not be afraid, your reward shall be very great. And Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. So, at this point, God has really not talked to Abraham at all about offspring. He said, you're going to be a great nation. So he says, I'm going to make you a great nation. So you and I would naturally kind of surmise out of that probably means he's going to have kids. But up to this point, Abraham's now getting to be quite an old man. He's not had any offspring, so he's beginning to do what you and I would do. God said this thing way back here. What does that mean? I'll be a great nation. How's that going to happen? Well, Eliezer is the heir of my house. Maybe, since you've given me no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Maybe that's how it's going to happen. Maybe it's through Eliezer. And so you can kind of see that processing that Abram is doing. But God's going to clarify for him here in verse 4. He says, behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside, and he said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. So here, God has now given him more details. He said, you are going to have an heir of your own body. Now, that's not going to be all of the details, because Abram has a wife. What's her name? Sarah. Sarah has still not going to is still not bearing a child. So at some point he's going to think, okay, but he said it's from my body, so maybe Sarah is going to give him Hagar. And so he's looking. It's like looking through binoculars, right? You can only see just a little bit, and he's trying to figure out how to make this thing work. But he does believe God. He believes God. If he says the offspring will come from my own body, it will. And then he asks God, how do I know I'm going to possess all this land? And God, what he's going to do is make a covenant with him. Now, what you read next is kind of an odd thing. He takes these animals, he cuts them in half, and he divides them and puts them on one half here and one half there. And then it talks about how he stays up and watches them, make sure the birds of prey stay off the carcasses. And then when the sun goes down, a deep sleep falls upon him. And behold, terror and darkness, great darkness fell upon him. That's verse 12. Now, verse 13, he says, God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. So he doesn't know, but where's that strange land going to be? Egypt. That's it, Egypt. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. We know how that's going to happen, which is, who's going to lead them out? Moses. How are they going to get all those many possessions? They're going to be given them. They're going to just ask, say, can I have your stuff? And they're going to give it to them. Does Abraham know any of this stuff? No. So it's important as we read, we remember what Abraham knows versus what we know. He says, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. And in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So now we're given another little detail. The people who are currently living in the land are bad people. We've seen that already some, but not long from now, we're going to see what happens to Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah, good people, bad people. Bad people, right? But what we find is that God says, I'm not going to give you this land right now. I'm going to wait till the fourth generation. I'm going to give it some time, and only then will I give it to your people, because at that point, the people who are living here, their sins will be full, which tells you something about the character of God. He's balancing some things, isn't he? He's saying, here, Abraham, I want to bless you and I'll give you this land, but I'm not going to be an unjust God and kick these people out of the land before they've earned it. Now, does God know that eventually their sin will become full? Yeah, God does know that. He is an omniscient God. But he's going to give them time to actually be bad, not just say, well, eventually you'll be bad, and so we'll do that. And so that's another detail that's added. So he tells them all of these things. And so Abraham now knows it will be his offspring. They will be given the land, but Abraham in his lifetime, how much of land is he going to get? He doesn't get the land in his lifetime, right? But he gets to live to a good old age and then be buried. And then it says, it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces, that is, the pieces of the animals. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite and the Hittite, the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. So the tough part in this chapter is these animals cut in half and then the smoking oven and the flaming torch. Let me tell you what I know, and then you can ask questions and I will tell you I don't know, because that's what it will come down to probably. From what I read in commentaries and people who study this time period, that was a common way of making a covenant, was for them to kill an animal, divide it, and then both people to walk through the pool of blood that was created by the divided animal. That was a common way of making a covenant back then. All I know is that that is what the archaeologists and whatnot have said. I don't know much beyond that, so I just have to take them at their word the same as anybody else. If that is the case, then Abraham at least would have understood what was going on, that God, with this smoking oven and flaming torch passing through these carcasses, is ratifying a covenant with him. And it seems to be that Abraham did understand, even though we may not understand the intricacies of making a contract like that. I mean, I guess you could imagine, maybe 1,000 years from now, people will tell stories about Americans and they'll say, they used to make contracts by signing their name 500 times in triplicate. And they would have stacks of paper and, like, I mean, if you describe like a real estate transaction, it might sound ludicrous to people 500 years from now. Kind of sounds ludicrous to us now. Most of the time you go and you just sign your life away. I try and compare the two, is that it doesn't make a lot of sense to us, this whole idea of making a covenant that way, but it seemed to make plenty of sense to Abraham. Like, he was not confused by it. He made these sacrifices. And then at the end of it, it says in verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. So it was understood, this is an agreement. Abraham had asked, God, how am I going to know that I'm going to possess all this stuff? And then he goes through this whole ritual with the animals and dividing them in half, and then the smoking oven and the torch and the vision of all those things, and that was God's answer. So whatever it was that was going on there that probably is some of it's culturally lost on us, it wasn't lost on Abraham. He got it, and he understood, oh, that's how I know, because God's made a promise to me. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything to illuminate that is beyond what I've mentioned? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. By the time you get to Isaac, definitely he firmly believed that God had made this promise. So yeah, there's no doubt Abraham, he got it deep in his heart. Yeah. Yeah. So everybody says the same thing with that, which is we're not entirely sure, but it seems to be. The best that I heard is you don't divide them because the birds are always done in pairs. So like, and actually under the Jewish law, that's always true too. You look, it's never like a turtle dove, it's always a pair of turtle doves. So since they're a pair, you've divided the pair. As far as the birds of prey, it just seems that vulture's going to do what vulture's going to do. As far as I can tell, that's all I know there, is that he's laid them out and then waiting for God, and you know, you've got dead things on the ground, and so he has to keep shushing them away. So yeah, that's the best I've got, which is not very great. Anybody else have anything? Okay, so then that moves us down into chapter 16. So now Abraham has this new level of knowledge of what God is promising him. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her. This is completely logical in their mind, right? Because the promise is that offspring will come from whose body? Abram's. It doesn't say Sarah. So Sarah, the way I look at it, is just kind of processing that and going, well, I can't have kids, but maybe this is the plan to use my handmaiden, which was not an unknown idea back then. You and I look at that as just the kind of this just crazy thing. But it wasn't crazy back then. It was culturally much more normal. It doesn't make it right. It just makes it more normal. There's plenty of things that we consider normal in today's culture that aren't right, right? So they just had different wrong normals. And so she makes this plan, and Abram listened to the voice of Sarah. After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife, and went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. So from this point forward, Sarah and Hagar are going to have problems with each other. And Sarah said to Abram, may the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. Let me paraphrase that. Abraham, fix it. But Abram said to Sarah, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. So Sarah treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. Now, all of this is unnecessary, right? This didn't have to happen. But let's go over to Galatians. Go back to the book of Galatians, where we were earlier, for a second. Since this has happened, it will be used as an allegory, something to throw alongside, a parallel for us to understand the difference between the covenant that you and I are a part of as Christians and the Jewish one. So in Galatians chapter 4, this relationship between Hagar and her child, who will be Ishmael, and Sarah, who will eventually have a child named Isaac, is brought to light. In Galatians 4, verse 21, he says, "Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman," the bondwoman is Hagar, right? "And one by the free woman," that is Sarah. "But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son by the free woman through the promise." The son born by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, meaning, was there anything miraculous about Ishmael's birth? Totally normal. It was just a normal, fleshly, natural process. But the son by the free woman, Sarah's son, Isaac, was through the promise. Was there anything miraculous, or will there be anything miraculous about Isaac's birth? Yes, entirely because God made it happen. In the case of Ishmael, Ishmael is because Abraham and Sarah made it happen. Isaac is purely because they waited for God and God makes it happen. And so he compares that to the two covenants, the Jewish one and the New Testament one that we have in Christ. He says, this is, verse 24, allegorically speaking, these women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother. For it is written, rejoice, barren woman who does not bear, break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for more numerous are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. You take the Jews. How does somebody become a Jew, first of all? The average person become a Jew. How do you do it? You're born, right? It's a natural process, right? It's a fleshly process. That's how the Jews grew as a nation. And then the other aspect of it is the Jews had a law from God, and Galatians talks about this quite a bit. The law taught them about sin. It taught them about right and wrong. And what was the lesson that every Jew was supposed to learn about themselves when they looked at right and wrong? Yeah, we're sinners. I've done the wrong thing. I'm a slave to sin. Under the old law, without Christ, is there any way out of sin? So the old law, all it does is teach you, you're a slave. You really are. You're not free. You're enslaved to sin. So you become a Jew, you live under that covenant, and the only thing it teaches you is that you need somebody to save you. You're counting on the promises. In their case, the promises were of who? Who were they waiting for? The Messiah. That's right. They're waiting for the promise of the Messiah. You and I are another covenant. We're the children of the promise. You and I recognize we're sinners before or after we become Christians. You figure it out before, don't you? Before you become a Christian, you realize, I have sinned, all of sin, and the wages of sin are death. And then you go to Christ, that Messiah who was promised, to save you from that sin, and you become a Christian, and the moment you become a Christian, you're no longer enslaved. Two covenants. So here, what we're seeing is, God is taking this circumstance back here of Abraham, and he has Hagar and Ishmael, and then we'll have Sarah and Isaac, and these two are going to have nothing but problems the whole way through, and it's a sad story. Like, we don't have to walk away and go, wow, this was a really, you know, why did this happen? It was all good. No, it was bad. There were lots of bad things, lots of very sad things that happened. Happened to the children, happened to the to Hagar, all sorts of different things. But God is using this to point out, which do you want? Do you want the life of Hagar and Ishmael, or do you want the life of Sarah and Isaac? It's just as clear as day, we want the Isaac life, right? And that's what can be found in Christ. It's the life of trusting in the promise instead of trying to make it work it out yourself. There, chapter 16. So now we have Hagar. She flees from Sarah. An angel Lord finds her by a spring of water in the wilderness. We're back to chapter 16, now in verse 8. He said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. And then the angel Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, the angel Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so they will be too many to count. And the angel Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. Ishmael literally means God hears. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers. And then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees." For she said, Have I even remained alive here after seeing him? Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahai Roy, and behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of the son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So Sarah, Hagar flees, but then is told to go back, submit to Sarah. Is she told to submit to Sarah because Sarah is being super nice to her and everything? No, it's just part of God's plan. And there's another lesson in there, right, about sometimes going through difficult things, even though it's part of God's plan, doesn't mean everything's going to be easy. That's the other piece of that story. And then on top of it, one other little detail, there is a group of people who consider themselves descendants of Ishmael today. Who is it? Muslims. The Muslim religion considers themselves descendants of Ishmael. In fact, up until this point, to about chapter 15 of Genesis, the Islamic religion teaches exactly the same thing as the Jewish religion. They teach exactly the same up to the point where Abraham has two sons, and the Jews say Isaac is the child of promise, and guess what the Muslims say? Ishmael's the child of promise. He's the special kid. One interesting little detail is that when you look at Ishmael, look at how he's described as a person. He will be a wild donkey of man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. Is that a fair depiction of what the Muslim religion is even today? I mean, it's just a fighting religion. And so there's just kind of this interesting kind of tie-in there that they associate themselves with Ishmael. Whether they actually are or not is a separate thing. But, that character trait. Yeah. I don't know the details of that. I would have to go and do a little bit more research into it. As far as all the specifics, I don't know. Yeah. That now you got me curious. I'm going to have to go back and do that. Any other comments or questions? Okay. So then we'll stop there. We're at time. We'll pick up in chapter 17 next week.